Discussion keeps the world turning.
This is Roundtable.
Nature enthusiasts and conservation champions, welcome to Roundtable. I'm He Young. Get ready for a wild ride as we kick off the first half of our show dedicated to protecting our planet's incredible wildlife. Then hold on to your seats because the second half is packed with something extra special. We're thrilled to present the world debut of CGTN radio production, the captivating radio drama Echoes of Kulang. Let's begin by stepping into a journey to explore the critical role of conservation efforts both in China and worldwide as we unite in our mission to protect and preserve our natural wonders. Joining us is a distinguished guest, Jamil Mendingma, Vice President for Global Programs at International Fund for Animal Welfare, or IFAW. Welcome to Roundtable.
Thank you, Yenang. It's a pleasure for me to be here and talk about this very important topic.
Yes, there's plenty that we can go into, and let's start with this particular day. World Earth Day is celebrated on April the 22nd around the world, and this year's theme is Planet versus Plastics. So tell us, how do plastics harm humans and biodiversity?
It's a great issue for the world to gather and celebrate the Earth, and we are clearly witnessing the deterioration of the Earth. And part of that is being advanced by plastics that are not biodegradable. As a society, we are really, our consumption habits are damaging the planet. And when they are not biodegradable and we have our wildlife species, they, as a part of their foraging, end up eating the plastics. They end up in the beaches, in the coastal areas, and the turtles get entangled and they can't digest the plastics. And you can say the same for other critters on land. I know in certain urban centers, wildlife goes to forage in the dustbins and they end up eating plastics. So at the end of the day, as we do that, we are damaging the soil, the substrate. And as a people, we should remind ourselves on Earth Day to say, let's not use plastics, but rather try to use containers and all kinds of materials that are recyclable.
Right. Well, I suppose many of us have come across those horrific photos of giant turtles, dolphins, and seals who accidentally consume the plastic bags as such, as well as microfibers getting into the bodies of fish. And then we end up seeing that in sashimi and, you know, our dinner plate. And that's just all a poignant reminder that we're all connected in this world. But I suppose for a lot of good-intentioned people, actually taking action can be a little bit difficult. And I wonder if you have any tips or tricks or maybe a powerful message to everyone that give us that push.
That's a great point. And in fact, we should never expect to leave this to government or to agencies. Each individual citizen has a role to play. Mm-hmm. If you don't drop plastic yourself, can you be part of the movement, raise awareness? We are fortunate in this digital age where social media, some people don't realize and appreciate the damaging effect of plastics. Mm-hmm. Send the message to raise awareness. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware for us at IFO and even where I live, people doing campaigns, cleanup campaigns. You go and pick plastics. You try to encourage the youth groups to do recyclable products using plastics so that they won't be put into the environment. Mm-hmm. They make money, but they are also raising awareness. We do beach cleaning up, you know, in places like in Kenya, where we work now on a pilot marine program, where people are producing products that can be used and actually serve the community. And if there's any opportunity as a citizen, be part of it, send the message, because some people don't know, let's form a movement to save the planet. And avoid use of plastics, which is really damaging all these critters.
Yes, I think that's definitely really promising. We're seeing change, and it's really exciting to see young people rise and get into the action. But also there's that other side of things, which is plastic is made from fossil fuel, and it's so cheap to make, but so difficult to wean off simply because convenience, I suppose. And also there are some powerful business interests behind it as well. So do you ever feel frustrated when every year we're talking to people about this issue, but there's also that kind of rigid aspect that doesn't really budge that much, it feels.
It's actually interesting because one of the things we realize is businesses that thrive on use of these incompatible materials often don't realize the interconnectedness of sustainability of their businesses. So luckily, the global communities finally agreed to rally on this particular issue. So you see, each time we go to various international conventions, the Convention on Biological Diversity, the UN Framework for Climate Change, people are now saying the right things, and we are hearing positive statements coming from the private sector, including those in this industry, saying they want to make commitments to do good. Now, as a people, we should say, walk the talk, and your production systems, your business products should be aligned to a safe planet, which is sustainable, which is healthy. And one way of doing that is to stop continuing to produce plastic and look at other materials that are good. But the business community is a big role. That's where the money is. They can plow it back to restore and come as part of the loss and damage, which they should actually contribute towards.
And there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
That's where the balance between money and what we need to do for sustainability and for the future generations. And in fact, what we are as a people is driven by the functionality of the ecosystems, and we are damaging it through the plastics and many other things that we do that are not compatible. So we need to really wake up and say, the time is now. We can't damage the planet under our watch. The future generation will really ask, what did you do? Because they can't see the things we are seeing now.
Indeed. On a global scale, what are some of the success stories that you can share with us? Also, what are the driving factors that bring these initiatives to success?
So IFO is a privilege to have worked for now 55 years. In the global community across 40-plus countries, partners from government, from local communities, other NGOs, and the private sector. And our work is focused on identifying the needs for individual animals. So where we are seated here, rescuing the raptors is important because they play a significant role in the ecosystem. Then also addressing issues of illegal offtake of wildlife and their derivatives. That is perpetuating a big illegal illicit value chain across the world. And our presence in the source countries, in the transit countries, and the demand market countries has helped to conscientize the consumers, some of whom do it innocently, but raising awareness to say what you are consuming is because it's taken from this ecosystem, and that takes a gruesome killing of an elephant, a rhino, any other creature, pangolins. So we address illegal wildlife crime across the world. And I'm glad to say part of the campaigns we did, even here in China largely, as well as across the globe, led to the banning of commercial ivory sales, the banning of rhino on consumption, and many other derivatives from animals that are endangered. And then we work on some of the key habitats that exist and actually are homes to megafauna on land, elephants, Asian elephants, African elephants, and in the marine space, in the oceans, the whales and many marine mammals, the dolphins, the seals. We have programs that transcend in different parts of the world. Last but not least, we work in Oceania, in Australia, the koala, a cuddly, lovely creature, and many others. We had in 2020 the fires that destroyed and we lost millions. So our work, again, rescuing, rehabilitating and releasing and then restoring the habitats. I feel like we are in a journey. We are making progress. We don't want to mistake progress for success because there's still a lot more to be done.
And certainly when you talk about the ban of ivory trade here in China in 2018, that was the big year when everything was official. The processing of ivory products as well as sales, that's all prohibited. And there has been great interest in wild elephants in this country in recent years. When we talk about African elephants, how are they different from their Asian brothers and sisters here? And what about the protection schemes? Are they any different?
It's interestingly, IFO chose to use elephants as our flagship species because they are big influencers on how the ecosystems function. And for now, we have prioritized focusing on the African savanna elephants in East and Southern Africa. We actually call them the gardeners or engineers of the ecosystems because they are so massive. If they pass through a thick forest, they destroy it and they open it up. And as they do that, they allow undergrowth. Where they step, those kind of footprints hold water and create a microclimate for other microbes that are important for the function. When they eat, they spread seeds. So then the equivalent of that, like you say, is the Asian elephant, which also is the shaper of the ecosystems in Asia. Their numbers are much lower than African elephants. Their space habitats has been shrinking over the years. And that's a parallel to also what we see in Africa. Part of the reasons is because of justified quests for humanity to improve our well-being through development, through modernization, cities, mega highway and railways, and many other food production systems. But what we are saying as an organization and why we are working on elephants is these creatures can only survive and thrive in habitats that are suitable. And once we lose those habitats, we cannot rebuild them because they take ages and they are very unique. And they are very intelligent creatures that know where they go. So their passages from generation to generation are the same. They may veer here and there because we're blocked by a fence or by a farm. So the parallels essentially are elephants need large space, both in Asia and in Africa. Mm-hmm. And as an organization, we have committed to an initiative we call securing room to roam for elephants. And what that means is negotiating with governments, with local communities and private landowners to zone the areas and identify where elephants do well and thrive because owners of land are proud of elephants and other wildlife. And then how do we set it aside so they can connect and move? And as they do that, they are able to adapt and respond to maybe situations where there's less water, there's less browse, but they still can survive and be able to be in other areas. And those that situation obtains in Africa and also in Asia. And here in China, luckily, you know, there is commitment from the top level, from government, from the relevant agencies and communities in southern China, where the Asian elephants are really building from very low numbers, you know, a few years back, but now really at a point where they are like 100% in number to almost 300 now, which is a good story to tell because they're important.
They are very important, and they're also, despite a lot of efforts, but the numbers are not huge. So it used to be 180 in the 1990s in this country, and it's blossomed to a precious 300 now. And it's due to decades of efforts from the top down, bottom up, you name it. The Chinese government has set up national parks, which are designated to the protection of the flora and fauna in that area. And that happened in 2021, as well as, you know, there are wildlife protection laws and funding. And all of these are great efforts to protect the species as well as their environment. And I remember speaking with one of your project managers, Chen Yue, in China. She spoke about setting up and operating an organic honey program. It's persuading the local people instead of coming to conflict with the elephants, but you farm honey. I thought that was a really interesting initiative to develop the local community as well as protecting the specific animal species we're talking about here. So I wonder if there are similar things happening in Africa, or how are these balancing acts coming about when essentially, I guess, we're talking about humans and animals fighting for resources and space?
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, you are on point because what we do is essentially meant to say animals and people should thrive together. And if you think back in centuries, the relationship of hunting and gathering was always there. There is a lot of very deep cultural, traditional, and spiritual connections between people and animals. So on one hand, they are proud of having this heritage in their doorstep, but they also need to produce food. to improve their well-being. So if we are protecting the habitats for elephants and other wildlife, we should not forget what's in it for the local people, because they've got to have a better quality of life. So they need to put food on the table. So any businesses or benefits that could accrue from having wildlife in their doorsteps should be able to contribute to them as well. So that could be in the form of ecotourism, which is the biggest in Africa, where people from various parts of the world travel to Africa to go on safari. The businesses are run by private sector, and what we are doing to benefit communities is to partner with communities and let them negotiate a good deal, because they own the land where the lodges are put. So they have a shareholding in the business, and then the private sector provides the marketing acumen that we don't need the local community to have. Employment is created, and people get jobs, and families are fed out of that. And they get money, dividends, and they plow it into their community projects. So that's one way of benefiting directly from elephants. But fast forward, producing their own food, organic food, is a source of pride and a way of life, both in China and Asia and in Africa. So that organic honey is a way of diversifying the rural economy, of saying, what else can you get from non-timber forest products, which is basically what we do in producing honey. And we professionalize that so they can access good markets and get some earnings back. But we know bees are key pollinators for food production and for the function of the ecosystem. So there's double wins there. Then secondly, we also want to say, how can they produce food efficient, climate smart agriculture? So we are infusing to say, if you put aside a zone for wildlife, what you put the zone for production food, you do it effectively. So you don't have to extensify and deforest the habitat, but you produce actually surplus from good practices using technology, using water efficiency and the right, you know, types of crops. And so food security is then they can sell some surplus. So this is how we are really aligning communities in Africa. And as part of tourism, besides the ecotourism lodge, there's so much culture in terms of people coming for cultural tourism, the dances, the folklore stories, and the food, the cuisine. So that becomes a downstream industry, then selling the crafts that they do. So that's part of what we do in Africa, to connect the wildlife benefit, the healthy ecosystem that they sacrifice, you know, as a trade-off, but then they get benefits from that. So that's what we do. And in China here, the honey is one part of it. I just came from down, you know, in Yunnan 2 days ago, and it's amazing what you see. And the testimonies, seeing the women's groups, seeing the chiefs, the community leaders saying, you know, we love this project, we love our elephants, it's good to see them increase. And now we're talking about how can we get involved in ecotourism, again, broadening the scope of benefiting from. But more important, the climate action as a result of having elephants, a healthy ecosystem, fresh air, which they enjoy, the peace you find there compared to cities, it's amazing.
Wow, that's quite the idyllic lifestyle that I guess a lot of city folks kind of dream of.
It's amazing when you go out there and you see the connected, the sacrifices that, you know, you have to give trade-offs, and yes, they are willing to do that as long as it's not one way.
Have you ever come across difficulties to get people on board, especially when maybe sometimes the benefits are really immediately presented?
Yes, there are always difficulties to convince people, and a lot of it is around, I'm almost like suffering from the protection, and the beneficiaries often tends to be external parties for the big profits. So the partnerships in terms of getting community, private, public partnerships are helping to incentivize. And then secondly, we have also decided to recognize the local authorities to say, how do we use the chiefs and the headmen to be able to be the conveners of local communities and the negotiators at global platforms. So they now go to conventions where the community voices, indigenous people and local communities, are speaking for their interests. So that has become very helpful. And we've also seen pretty successful cases where partnerships have worked and communities actually attest to say, we are benefiting from being part of the solution, because they are happy to have the wildlife, but it can't just be wildlife protected for people that fly in and fly out while they are still in poverty. So I think that is very key. And then there's always the situation of people that, like in every society, are not convinced that there is value, which is why we end up monetizing the value. Yet for communities, it's about the pride of living in a health community in something that they identify with culturally and traditionally, and there's a totem. So I think that buy-in is there. And I was just reminds me of a session I was at in last September in Jackson. We were talking about why culture and tradition are important ways of protecting biodiversity, because that value in itself is important, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Also, today where we are having this discussion is in the Beijing Raptor Rescue Center, and you can see these lovely pictures of raptors and powerful birds, big and small, their presence around us. This might come as a surprise for some people, but actually in big cities like Beijing, Shanghai, as such, these are important places for the protection of wildlife as well. I'm curious for you to speak a little bit about your consideration in setting up a place like this in a big bustling city like Beijing, and we're pretty central.
I know. So just like we're talking about elephants using the traditional paths, raptors fly over Beijing, so it's a pathway for them. And then they end up landing or being affected by the infrastructure, by the pollution. Being able to partner with the Beijing Normal University brings in the scientific competence and practices of how we are able to rescue the raptors, rehabilitate them, and get them back to the wild. And that in itself is fantastic to do in a big city like Beijing, where we've got the best of brains contributing to our teams that are fantastic and committed to one of IFOR's biggest values of every individual animal matters, because it has got a role in the system. So it is proud to come here and talk about over the last 30 years, we have rescued over 5,000 raptors and been able to rewild 55% plus of those. Yeah. That's a good story to tell. Our wish is to rewild all of them, but we just do our best. Yeah. And that allows, you know, China to continue to be a big protector of this critical, you know, species that are around the Beijing area.
Yeah. Didn't you guys set free a raptor which has received full treatment and now is fully capable to go back into the wild? And that must be...
I felt so privileged to be able to go to the Great Hall and to other places to just see the magnificent, you know, World Heritage sites here, but also to be able to be part of the releasing of the bird and just say, look here, we bring you, we rehabilitate you, attend to the issues of injury, and then go and soar out there and do what is needed in the ecosystem. So it's a source of pride to us, but we do it because of, again, the facilitation of the Beijing Normal University, the many players in the private sector, and I have to say a very dedicated team here in China. I can't say enough about how I appreciate my colleagues that work here, long hours, but the passion. You don't do this work for material benefits. It's good to be rewarded, but the most value is passion.
Right. There are some good people out there, but some people aren't just that interested. So why should we care? Let's talk to everyone about this.
Right. What can you do and why is it important? The water, the air, and everything you take for granted is a result of a balanced ecosystem. And the work we do with raptors, with Asian elephants, with protecting ecosystems, is what ends up making you feel proud and enjoy the luxuries you do in cities, in communities. The food you eat is only produced and only healthy if we maintain that balance. And that is why we should care. What can you do? Spread the message. Raise awareness. Do something about it. Play your part. And that's how we can save the planet and save ourselves.
That's Jamil Mandima, Vice President for Global Programs at International Fund for Animal Welfare, or IFAW. By furthering sustainable practices, advocating for stronger protections, and fostering a deep reverence for all living beings, we can pave the way for a brighter, greener future.